Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
You're good. I know you guys got a heavy topic. Hey, Kaylee came. She wanted to do it.
Only one I've ever done. Might be my last.
Hey, it's Todd. Before we get started, if you like what you hear or you have any questions about this podcast, please tweet at me at @Todd_Garner on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
This is Jeff Probst.
I'm Kaylee Cuoco.
I'm Eli Roth.
This is Marlon Wayans.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Everybody, this is Kevin James, and this is The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
The word that comes up time and time again on this podcast is authenticity. Authenticity is really the cornerstone of storytelling. And authenticity comes from your history, your education, the people you're around, the types of interests you have, the stories you gravitate towards, and the stories that you want to tell, the things you're passionate about. It's the only thing that makes you you as an individual. And that is ultimate power, because there's nobody else like you to be able to tell that story. And as we are in this 500 channel universe and we have streamers and we're making more and more content, we need more authentic stories and we need more voices and we need more original voices and we need different voices. And the only way that's gonna occur is to open the doors and let more people in the room. And that has been changing, albeit slowly, in our business, most famously with the Time's Up movement. And women and people of different backgrounds and color are being asked to come into these rooms and tell their stories. And that is great. And that is the best way to have a pastiche of different stories rather than, as one of my next guests so aptly puts it, just stories from the same people that are telling the same stories, that are hiring the same people and telling stories out of habit. Kaylee Cuoco and I have been friends for a while, and we have a project together that she is a producer on, and she is just wrapping up her last season of her huge hit TV show. And at first we were talking about having her come on the podcast to talk about network television and how it's changing, and this sitcom in particular, The Big Bang Theory. Will there be another big TV show in the foreseeable future that has the same kind of impact as The Big Bang Theory? And as we started to talk about that and her experience on the show and who she is as a person and becoming a producer, the conversation really evolved into, well, let's talk about women in the business and how things are changing or not changing, and how we can help people that are listening to this podcast in the business, and maybe help people that want to get into the business, maybe give them some advice on what they should be doing to get into the business if you're a woman or a person of color. And she wanted to bring on Sarah Schechter, who is a massively successful producer. She was a wonderful executive at Warner Brothers and now is a partner at Berlanti Productions, and they have a number of huge TV shows on. And so we wanted to deep dive into all of those things that are plaguing our media right now and really talk about diversity and really talk about empowering women, specifically as storytellers, and how you go about ultimately becoming a Kaylee Cuoco or a Sarah Schechter. Enjoy.
Hello, I'm Brad Jenkins, host of the Fired Up podcast. We're fired up that you're joining us. And that is the whole point of the podcast. We're going to have guests on to talk about the thing that they love the most. We picked the perfect first guest, Senator Cory Booker.
Here we are getting Jersey Shore jokes every 5 minutes.
Because of a bunch of people from Staten Island, no less.
I mean,
yes!
They didn't even live in Jersey and they gave us a bad name.
Fired Up with Brad Jenkins. New episodes weekly. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts and at podcast1.com.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
This is The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
All right. I'm here with Kaylee Cuoco and Sarah Schechter. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having
us.
This
is awesome.
It's my first podcast ever.
This is
very surreal, I feel like.
Isn't this weird?
Right? So... You guys are two massively successful people in the business,
all, you know, specifically in the television business. Sarah has produced, I think, every TV show on the air right now.
She has.
Except for the really successful one, Kayla.
You mean like Big Bang Theory?
Except for Big Bang Theory, and you're on Big Bang Theory, so there you go. Sarah, you were an executive at Warner's for a very long time, and then you are the head of the Berlanti Productions.
Yes.
This is not the Berlanti, it's just Berlanti Productions.
Yes, whatever.
And like, you guys, I think, have 43 shows on the air right now.
No, I think we have 18.
That's unbelievable.
18 shows, a lot in the DC universe.
Yep.
Your television deal is through Warner Brothers, correct?
Yes. Yes.
And so what made you decide to go from features to television back in the day?
Looking back on it now, I realize how I basically raised myself in front of a television, but I never thought of TV as a career. Somehow I only thought movies were a career.
Did you grow up in California?
No, I was born in Boston, then I grew up in New York.
And you went to UC Santa Cruz?
I did.
Right on.
Banana Slugs. And then the best mascot ever. And so about 5 years, I had known Greg Berlanti for about 10 years. And 5 years ago, I was ready to leave being at a studio because it is, I think Billy Gerber said this, maybe someone else. It said basically like being a studio executive is a great job and a terrible life, and being a producer is a great life and a terrible job.
Yes.
And
why didn't anyone tell me that?
No, sorry, it's too late for you.
And being an actress on a hit TV show is the best job.
When that works.
And the best life.
When that happens, it's
great. Oh my God, all I want to be is on a multicam as an actor.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about leaving, and Greg called me and he said, he had been saying for years, you're a producer, what are you doing there? And I'd started off working for producers, and I'd always wanted to be a producer. I never sort of meant to fall into the studio life, but then I did. And so I said, I don't know anything about TV. And he said, I can teach you in 2 weeks. It's just story. And it really is.
Yeah.
And so it probably took closer to a year to really understand, but it is. It's all storytelling. It's all working with writers and actors and other producers. And what's fun is in TV, there's a little less of an emphasis on the third act.
Right. Because
it keeps going, yeah.
And so, Kayla, you grew up you grew up in California. Also because I grew up in California.
Yeah, that's rare.
And,
I know.
And did you always want to be an actress? Like, what motivated you to do this?
It never was a decision for me. You know, I've been doing this since I was 5 years old. And when I was very, very young, this was just one of the things on the list that my parents had me do. You know, I played sports. I loved tennis. I obviously went to school. I went to a bunch of camps. And then I also went on auditions. And it just was another thing. And my parents were pretty brilliant. They've kind of gone by that for years, not all eggs in one basket. And so nothing was ever too, if I didn't get a job, I would go to, you know, I was at tennis camp and I did all these great things. And as years went on and I started to work a little bit more, I remember distinctly the conversation where they sat me down. They said, do you want to do this for real? Because you really got to pick one if you do. And I said, yeah, I think I do. And it was that simple of an answer. There was never any decision, never anything else in my mind. It was always something. It just was a part of me. I was an actor. There was no decision. My parents were absolutely awesome. There was no push. It was like letting me know, though, it was a serious decision.
When did you realize you were funny?
Am I funny?
Yeah. And I think the world thinks you're funny, too.
I've always loved being silly, and I've loved not taking myself seriously. My parents still have videos of me when I was little, and my dad would do these little camera things where I would have to do all these faces and silly things, and we had hundreds of videos just showing my expression. And I obviously loved the camera at a very, very young age. I loved making my dad laugh. That was a big part of it.
Do you remember movies or television specifically growing up that really affected you and where you were like, I got to do that?
I do. I really grew up with like Seinfeld and Friends.
Right.
And watching Friends specifically, it was on Thursdays, and I would sit with my family. We'd watch it every Thursday. It was on for 10 years, and I loved it. And I loved Seinfeld, and I loved Frasier, and I loved the audience, hearing the audience laugh, and seeing people, you know, do and knowing they're doing takes over and over, and deciding, like, what are they going to choose, and how did they do that, and seeing the camaraderie between the cast. It just always, it was so interesting to me, and I wanted to be on a sitcom, and I wanted to make people laugh. Like, it's not rocket science, you know?
And also it's that immediate
unless it's
feedback.
Big Bang Theory.
Well, then you end up on Big Bang and you become a scientist.
But it also is that immediate gratification because there is a live studio audience.
Yes.
So you do have that instant feedback of, are you being funny or aren't you?
It's cool. You know, on Big Bang specifically, I think a lot of sitcoms or multicams, they're constantly rewriting as the night goes on. And with our show, it was really unique because whatever our script was, it was exactly what it was, and we shot it. And there were very few moments where the audience didn't like it, but they sure told you when they didn't.
Right.
Especially on that show, because it was so specific and the characters were so loved. So for one moment you were making fun of a character, they didn't like it and they told you right away. And I love that response, knowing exactly how they felt, and then you rewrite it and make them happy. Yeah. And they represented the world to us.
The equivalent of that is the preview process that we go through on features. Yeah. You instantly know if something doesn't not working. It's the longest moments of silence.
It's the worst.
Waiting for the first laugh in a movie is the longest.
Oh, like in the audience or something?
Yeah, when you do a test screening and you're just waiting, and you're just like, are they going to laugh at this one?
And you know, kind of when you're going to get going, like you know when the engine...
When you're supposed to.
And it's it's always the same thing too when you're previewing, right? You go, I'm going to leave some things in there, see if they work, and you instantly regret it.
Oh my gosh, oh my gosh.
It's not working, please get me out of here.
Right.
So what about you, Sarah? Do you remember movies or television growing up that totally influenced you?
Oh, absolutely. No, I've basically watched movies and TV that was my main sport. Is that a sport?
Yeah, sure.
Is that a sport? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I watched a ton. I had seen like every Hitchcock movie by the time I was 8. I loved E.T. My mom and I went after school every day for a week. See E.T. every day. Oh. And then I watched like tons of comedy. I loved Seinfeld growing up. I mean, I grew up also with like Family Ties and all those great shows, and then I Love Lucy was always on TV, and growing up in New York, Twilight Zone was on every New Year's Day all day, and so I grew up watching a lot of different kinds of movies and watching a lot of different kinds of TV. And then when I was in high school, my two favorite shows were 90210 and Twin Peaks.
Wow.
And then, you know, then we got to do Riverdale.
I was just going to say, and you're doing Riverdale.
Yeah.
Nah, you took my line. I was like, that was going to sound so smart.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
And so being on a huge hit TV show for so long, famously, you, when everybody was like ready to renegotiate, you all banded together, and you specifically being, you know, at that time, one of the lone women on the show very publicly said, no, I should get paid as much as everybody else, which is absolutely correct. And you succeeded in that endeavor. And Sarah, I would say you're arguably one of the biggest producers in the business right now. What I really wanted to sit and talk to you guys about today and sort of deep dive into this is what's happening in our business in terms of female empowerment, in terms of, you know, our shows really making a shift and being more inclusive, because it feels like there's a lot of lip service paid, but then you see a lot of reports that it's like, oh, there's fewer female directors than ever. So it doesn't feel, it feels like everybody's really being conscious of it, but, and I know that you have a female partner in your producing company. So walk me through, and either one of you can start, kind of how you did it. Were you aware? Has it always been just that you were one of the few women in the room? And then sort of, I want to get to, what advice do you have for either women in the business to get to your level, or people that are wanting to get into the business and are like, how the hell do I do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me it was very, I even was aware, because the first thing I wanted to be was a director, because that was sort of the only job I knew existed. Mm-hmm. And I was very aware of, like, I was like, oh, Penny Marshall's a director. That's it.
Right.
I mean, that was the end of the list. That was the beginning of the list and the end of the list. And she was Laverne, and that was cool. But as there's been a shift, it continues to shift in a positive direction. But certainly when I was coming up, a lot of the women that were in positions of power had fought so hard to get to them that they kind of felt like, this is the one chair that's for women, and I'm going to hold on to it.
Right.
Versus now it feels a lot more like the women are sort of like, let's turn more chairs into chairs for women, and let's find more equality. But I think that the problem is just business as usual means business as usual, and habits are habits. And so hiring your friends that you went to Harvard with is a habit.
Right.
Hiring people that look like you is a habit, and telling stories about people like you is a habit. And so when the people that are telling the stories are all sort of like educated white guys, you get a lot of stories about white guys. And so I think it's sort of, it's been a shift in multiple directions. It's both producers wanting to tell stories about women. It's executives being women or being male executives that really care about female stories, and recognizing also the economics of it. First of all, more people, women watch TV than men. Like, why aren't we telling stories about women to women? And women still go to the movies, you know, which mm-hmm. like for forever, 15 years ago, it was all about young boys, mm-hmm. getting young boys into the theater. And now it's like you can't get them off their computers. Right. So you should be, so it's just, it's good economic sense to make stories about women. But I do think that it's this, habits are hard to break, and you have to be very conscientious and really self-aware about the things that you do by rote, the stories you tell, the casting, the just all of it. I think you have to make such an effort. And I do think it's changing, and I think it's getting better. But still, most of these big companies are run by men.
Yeah. Well, that's how this really came about, because Kaylee did say that you were a mentor to her and really helping her.
It's so hard because I'm so much younger than her. It just seems weird to be a mentor.
You're so smart, even when you're just talking right now. She probably doesn't know how inspirational she's been to me over the last year, but oh, she has been. So no, she's amazing.
And you have made a shift to have your production company and to really put your stamp on things and really kind of take more of your career into your own hands in terms of a producer. A, why did you decide to do that? And B, how has it been for you?
My story a little bit is slightly different than I feel like other women in the business. Going back a tiny bit to the beginning of Big Bang, like first year beginning, even at that time, so that would be many, many years ago. At that time, it was me, Johnny, and Jim. They had considered the main three. And I didn't know there was such drama around women getting the equal pay and all the time. Because at that point, even at that time, however many years ago, 13 years ago or whatever it was, I was going to be equal to them, mm-hmm. like no matter what. And this was that long ago. And there was never a question about it even then. And then obviously going in and I did, and my whole team, and I did at that time. And I never felt left out, or I never felt like it was an issue, because for me it was a no-brainer. So then as the years went on, and obviously negotiation, all this stuff, I was always equal to them. Mm-hmm. And it was a standard I had set for myself my entire career. So I never felt anyone against me. I just knew that was the decision that was going to be made, and my team knew that. So going on now after Big Bang and saying, okay, what's life after? It's women have to take their careers into their own hands, even if you come off the biggest show in the world. Like, it doesn't matter. You're only as good as your next project. And it's been super important to me to put my stamp on it. It's been super, you know, I hired my VP, Suzanne McCormick, who's this wonderful. She used to work for Chuck Lorre, long story there. And he blessed me with her, which was great. And I owe a lot to Chuck over the years, sure. By the way. He's been wonderful to me. But it was important now to have my own, I feel like I've earned my spot in the business, and I want my handprint on everything, and I want to make my own decisions, and no man or woman is going to make that for me.
Can I say, it's so interesting, and I find this with most women, just even you saying you've earned your spot. It's like no guy would say that.
Oh,
that's,
no.
That's so interesting to me.
My friend Dana Fox always says, what would a white guy do?
Yeah.
And I think it's really important.
Because I've had a bunch of dudes on this show, and everybody's – none of them have said, I feel like I've earned my spot. They're just
right.
Like,
yeah, that's
I'm
true.
I'm in the business, and I'm going to f***ing take it, and I'm going to keep going.
As women we apologize a lot. We don't want
to
take up too much space.
True.
We don't want to come off as being arrogant or obnoxious. And truthfully, because women just get torn apart for having certain qualities that men are expected to have.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so I do think it's a, and having been like an executive and corporate kind of, there's a delicate balance of how you have to walk to, you know, the being strong is not for men. I think if men are strong, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And if women are strong, they can be too strong. They can be too tough.
Oh yeah.
You know?
No, I've had a couple guys in the business who've said to me, "Oh, you have your own company now," and have really said it like that.
Oh, yeah.
And I really choose to I don't listen to that stuff. I'm very, I don't know. I just kind of move on. But when I think about it, and I think of the way they've said that to me a little, I'm like, well, let's see if I end up hiring you in the future.
Right.
You know, it's like, but the way they've kind of said it, it was like it was cute. You know, like it was cute. I'm like. Is interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
And how did you two meet? And then why, what did you see in Kaylee that made you decide this is somebody that I want to, and I'm not saying that you don't do this to everybody, but
no,
what was it
me.
About Kim?
specifically, I'm her favorite.
That you
no,
saw
true.
And
I'm
you
her
said,
favorite.
This is, and what advice
well, so,
did you
yeah,
give
her? Yeah, no, so what happened was that Warner's called us about a project that Kaylee had. It's a book that Kaylee found and a writer that Kaylee had found. And so honestly, you would think that with as much as Greg and I have done, that people would give us stuff a lot. It really does not happen.
No, that
and that's like such a
100%.
People just think, oh, it must be so easy
yep.
for
They're
them.
They're doing their own stuff.
Everyone
yeah.
sends them everything. Nobody
right.
ever sends us anything. So one, I was flattered.
Me either.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, this is the thing
they
we talk about
that.
All the time on this podcast with all of my producer friends is people do think, oh, you just, the agents call you and then you get, you know, and you just walk onto your next movie and your next movie. It's just absolutely not
no,
that way.
No, not at all. And so first of all, I was like, sort of flattered that anyone thought of us for anything.
Crazy.
And then read the material and we're like, there's really something here. And the idea of Kaylee doing it, I think Kaylee is incredibly talented. And then, but I wasn't sure until we met, you know, and what I got from meeting with Kaylee was what I look for in any of our, because part of Greg and my success is finding great collaborators, you know, and finding great people that we want to work with. That's how you can build more, is if you build with people.
Mm-hmm.
And Kaylee just had such a clear vision for what she wanted this to be, and a firmness but an openness. And that's what you're looking for in someone you want to partner with, is someone who has a vision and someone who isn't, you're not looking for someone who's arrogant, who's like, I know exactly what I'm doing and I'm mm-hmm. going to do all of it my way, but someone who has a real strong gut for what is a yes and what is a no. And I think that's really important. And so as we started working together, we just got along really well. And I became just more and more impressed with Kaylee and with Suzanne, who were starting, you know, from scratch.
Oh, yeah.
But,
totally.
But coming
we're
in.
A year old,
and,
really.
Yeah. And it's on the one hand, you know, Kaylee's been working in this business since she was the feed. I'm sure you were in like some sort of print ad in womb.
Oh, I was. JCPenney.
Yeah. And so
Bullocks.
She's definitely been in the business forever and has really seen lots of success and lots of failures and all that stuff. And so she's not, it's not like she's been a producer for 1 year. You know, the thing about this business, you know, is any job, and this is great advice for any job you can get in this business, you will osmosis, you will end up learning so much and what you observe. But Kaylee just had a real sort of vision for it, and she's been incredible to work with, and it's also been fun because these
fun,
hours
yeah.
are terrible
yeah.
so yeah. it might as well be fun.
Yeah. And have you at your company felt the shift since the Time's Up stuff and the Me Too stuff? Have you felt a shift at your company? Because you like you said, you have 18 shows in the air, so I would feel like you would have your finger on the pulse more of a sea change than, you know, most people who are just, you know, on one show or stuck in a writer's room
yes
somewhere.
And no, and I think it's what I was saying earlier, is about the habits. If people are just in the habits of every scene should be servicing the male lead, then you just have to call it. People, though, I think they want to change. They don't want to do stuff that feels really one-sided or myopic in their worldview. I think that they just aren't conscious. I think we're rushing. We're doing so much, and people don't think about it. And so they hire the directors they've hired before. They hire the crew they've hired before. And making a conscious effort to say, hey, stop, slow down. Like, how many women directors do we have this season? How many women writers do we have? What is our racial, ethnic, what's the true diversity of the voices that are creating these stories? And I think that's just been an ever-evolving process, but in a good way. And Greg's always sort of been very, very cognizant of the strength that comes out of that. We just did this miniseries with Ava DuVernay, and Ava is so conscious of it. And,
oh, yeah.
And it is not something that she pays lip service to. I mean, she has launched more female directors' careers off of like 3 seasons of Queen Sugar than most people have in their careers. And so I also learned a lot from her in terms of that, like the firmness with which you can apply your standard, your minimum standard is like, and now I think one of the things that's changed is now I'll get on a phone with an agent and they'll be pitching someone even for our show, and I'll be like, no, we want a female director.
That's
you know?
What I love about Sarah. This is what she doesn't realize, how inspirational she is, because that's just how she answers. Like, she's like, yes or no. And you have such a strong gut, obviously, a strong gut feeling, and you know when it feels right or not, and she doesn't care about the bullshit. Like, it's yes or no. There's no gray, which is the personality that I have as well, which is, I think, is why we get along so well. But it's inspiring to see her not cower to anyone. I mean, we're in rooms with a ton of men all the time, and she heads the whole room. Like, and I watch her, I'm like, I mean, I think I've told numerous people that I want to be her. There's so many things that she does that she doesn't even realize, which is why she's gotten to this point. It's really impressive to watch from someone like me to watch.
I mean, your character was so well written throughout the years. Did you find, as Penny, moments where it didn't feel authentic to you or to the female experience? And were those writers' rooms pretty diverse, or were you sort of, you know, the lone voice in these things sometimes?
You know, now that looking back at like the pilot or season one, anyone knows how difficult it is to even get a pilot done, get it shot, get it, have it be picked up. And then the first season is all about trying to get these characters to even to be interesting. It's tough trying to get that off the ground. So if I look back at season one, did I play the hot girl next door for a minute? Absolutely. But it grew. I mean, the writers fell in love with me and I fell in love with them, and I became the eyes and the voice of the audience and of the rest of the world, you know? And she was the one who ended up kind of being the genius. She was the one. She had the street smart. She was smarter than them half the time. And there was that respect that these characters ended up having for her and that she ended up having for them. But it took a minute to get into, and this is many years ago, but it's so weird to say it was many years ago because we just wrapped. But early on, it definitely was different. Thinking of the writer's room now, see, I'm so being now this quote producer that I am now. I'm looking at things
you have to
totally differently.
Sure.
And that was pretty heavily, we had a couple female writers, but it was definitely a lot of men. But I wouldn't have thought of it until now, and just these last few months of experience, even us like building our writer's room now for the project that we have together, Sarah and I, that even that's been an interesting experience, and making it diverse and having every person from every walk of life and a different voice. And that's just very new for me. I've never been on that side. So I like now being on that side so that I can give that opportunity to the people that I think are right for it.
But I think actually Kaylee just touched on something, though, that why she's a good producer and what's important about being a good producer is she said she fell in love with the writers. She, you know, and that she liked the writer's room. I think, like, recognizing the contributions, and you know this as a producer, recognizing the contributions that everyone makes to a project and encouraging all of them to do their best work is such an important part of it. And I think Kaylee just innately, because she does like people and is interested in them, that it encourages people to, and as an actor, it's also smart because then they want to write for you because they like you.
Right. And what about you in your various writer's rooms? I mean, every show in the world, but your show specifically have a very good balance cast-wise of male-female, and you obviously have Supergirl, and you have all these female-driven shows, too. When you're choosing your writer's room, do you take that into consideration, or are you always just trying to make it balanced and diverse regardless? But the reason why I say that, I just... The thing that always has annoyed me as an executive, and I talked about this with Marlon Wayans and a couple other people, is when I was an executive, just made movies. You know, it's like we made movies that happened to have Ice Cube in it or happened to have Marlon in it. It wasn't like a specifically African-American experience. And so my question is, when you have a show that has a female lead versus a male lead, that doesn't seem to be the – I don't know. Maybe it's just me. It feels like if it – just because it's a female lead, oh, then you're going to do it. It feels like you should always do it because the story is obviously Penny was in the show, and every one of your shows has a female cast members. You know, the stronger you can make each of those characters, the better the show is going to be, right?
Oh, absolutely. And also the thing that's great about TV is it's – you got a lot of episodes. You have to fill in multiple characters versus a movie where you can kind of be like – I guess no one else was very dimensional, just those leads, but that's what I remember.
Right.
I think it is something to be conscious of, and I think I get more conscious of it. Honestly, like, I think that there's also, I've started to realize walking into a couple writers' rooms, like, oh man, there's one black person in this room. How much does it suck for them that there's only one, that they're the one? So anytime there's, like, everyone turns to them, they're supposed to speak for their whole community, and that's just not, that's not cool either, you know? And so trying to, we just continue to evolve and realize like what actually feels right and what feels like an accurate reflection of the world we all live in.
Right. Yeah. And I had the showrunner, creator, showrunner of Handmaid's Tale on, who's male. And they really made a concerted effort to find
his staff is mainly female.
Well, yeah. Well, that yeah. His story is they tried. You know, they just wanted to MGM just wanted to find the best writer, and he had the best take, but would instantly very conscious of like, I cannot do this. I can't. I can do the pilot, and so I can start there, but I have to have almost everybody be a woman in my writer's room because I will run out of things yeah. in 5 seconds.
Yeah.
And being able to have those honest conversations about the you know, the things they're dealing with in that show.
Yeah, and I don't think it's like only women should tell stories about women or
that's right. the
and
other
or
thing.
Men should tell stories about men or gay actors should only play gay characters or any of that stuff. I think like it's about and hopefully an expansive vision of the universe. And so I totally – and I think – I love Handmaid's Tale. Thank God he did it. Mm-hmm. I think it's such a great
so
show, and it's sort of become like a very accurate prediction of certain southern states.
Sure.
So, you know, I think that the – no one should feel like they can't – like some – I don't know. There are some male writers that have written the strongest, most interesting female characters I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, think about, like, what Jim Brooks has done over his
sure.
career.
Yeah.
He writes incredible women and vice versa,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I think it is just making sure there's enough room at the table, enough seats at the table, enough tables that different experiences can be dramatized.
And also, it shouldn't just be on women to mentor other women, because you obviously have
yeah, but
Greg
I've also
and
had,
you had Chuck.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
I've had a lot of men, like Alan Horn,
right.
Jeff Robinoff. Like there have been a lot of – Barry Mendel was my first boss. Like
yeah.
a lot of men have – and I think also 15 years ago it was harder for women to mentor other women because they were so like – they're the only woman there and they're
right.
afraid, you know, if they brought someone else in, another woman in, they'd get kicked out.
Wow.
I mean that was the kind of the vibe. And so I think that's changed in a great way. But no, we should all be – you know, honestly, mentoring each other, it
yeah.
just makes the work better.
Yeah. And so coming up through the ranks, both of you, what advice would you have now for people coming into the business? Like what is the tenor of our business right now? And where do you see it headed? And if you're a young woman trying to say either in the business now or trying to figure out how to get promoted or wanting to be in the business, what advice would both of you have for people in those
situations?
Well,
when I started auditioning, oh no.
I think for me, especially because I know I've been in this business for like 25 years, which mm-hmm. is really wild to say out loud. This is a new part for me. This is a new path for me. And I appreciate you saying I kind of in my head have always been a producer, Sarah, but I haven't. Like this is like looking at a writer's room. Look, it's different. So I think for me, the advice that I'm wanting to give to other young women is let people help you.
Mm-hmm.
To me, Sarah doesn't even know how much she's helped me, but
she does now.
She does now.
That's why we did this. So
I know.
You guys could get together.
Yes.
We could tell Sarah how great she is.
I have a record of it.
Yes.
I can listen to it before bed.
You can listen to it whenever she wants.
Every night she's going to play this for herself.
I'm a healer. That's
yeah, you are. This is a therapy session. I'm so happy. No, but let people help you and know that you don't know everything. I can definitely be a little bit of a know-it-all. Like, I just can. And getting now on this side of things, I don't know everything. And watching her, she knows so many different people. She's been doing this a long time. Find people that can help you, not just getting you where you need to be, but help you along the way. Hold your hand. Be like, you know, and be okay with that you don't know everything. This business is constantly evolving. There's so much to learn. And you find your voice. And she has actually really helped me find my voice because I trust my instinct. And I feel like that's how I got here.
That is so important.
And ask questions.
Yeah.
I think
questions.
That's the other thing.
Yes.
We're all like think that's somehow a sign of weakness or insecure. I still ask questions. I still like
how many emails do I send though? And I'm
yeah.
like, this is going to be the dumbest question.
And I'm
but
always like,
it's not dumb.
It's never dumb. It's never a dumb question. I mean, I'll tell you when it is.
She,
I'm sure
she's
it'll
told
come.
Me a few times. It's dumb.
But I think that the asking questions, and this is also good advice, is. First of all, people like to be able to share what they know. I mean, that makes people feel good. And it also, how are you supposed to know these things?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was like my willingness to ask tons of questions, especially when I started working in TV. I didn't know what like an amort was. I didn't know any of that. And you're just asking questions doesn't make you seem weak. It doesn't make you seem stupid. It makes you seem engaged. And it makes you seem teachable.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to get better at your job is to be engaged and be teachable.
Yeah. And what you were saying about finding your voice is so important because we talk about authenticity a lot on this podcast. And so And I know that that word can sometimes be daunting, and it's just about being authentic to yourself, finding your own voice, finding what you love, finding what room you want to be in, and then drilling down into that as deeply as possible. Because if you can do that, then you're different than anybody else. You're going to come at things from a completely different point of view, which is what you were saying about your writer's room too. You don't want to just be the one lone, you know, whatever you are in a room, because then you're speaking only from your experience, and it may not ring true for anybody else other than that person. It's not fair.
It's just not fair to have to speak for all women or all of anything. But I do think that the authenticity is also, especially when producing, you know, Kaylee went after this book that was just like on Amazon. It wasn't, you know, how often in producing it's like, this hot book is coming out and it pre-sold for $2 million. And then you read it and you're like, this isn't very good. But so many producers, I think, get caught up in this heat seeking because it's so hard to get anything done. So I understand why you do it. You think this will be easier. Oh, and this will happen quickly. This will be, but you kind of, the authenticity is also that internal authenticity of like, what am I excited by? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's something like, Greg and I do really well together is like we'll both lose faith in something at a different time.
Yeah.
Which is really helpful.
Then the other one can
help
you.
And then the other one you go, no, I still think this is really cool. Yeah. And then you can, because there are those moments, but you have to have that authentic feeling of like, I am the right person to try and bring this to life, you know, because you're going to have to convince a lot of people along the way.
Yeah. And what makes you you gives you the advantage. Whether you're male, female, African-American, you know, Asian, doesn't matter. You know, if your authentic experience of either growing up or whatever you're interested in or being influenced by, you know, Seinfeld or different kinds of movies gives you the advantage in producing, gives you the advantage in this business because you're going to come at this in a completely different way than anybody else comes at it. You may see something in this book that was on Amazon that everybody else overlooked and it could become the next hugest thing. Again, what you're saying is right. Just find that thing that speaks to you. Don't worry about what everybody else is
doing. Go with your gut. It's really about that inner voice. Like, I have a very strong gut feeling. I have my entire life. And I'm starting to truly believe in it. And you got to go with that gut feeling. If you feel like it's right, it's right. And it's going to be right for you. And you might be wrong down the line, but also put the team around you. Have a great team around you. I've been with my same team since I was 13 years old.
Which is amazing. Kaylee never fired her team to go to CAA or WME or anything like that. She's still with like basically like kind of a children's agency.
Yes. I'm with a child's agency. And it's been still going great. I get a lollipop every time I go into the office. It's worked well for me. They don't even have any other clients anymore. They're all grown up and it's closed. The agency is shut down. But they just worked with me.
They just come to your pool.
Yeah.
They send you out for like just commercials.
I have my headshots.
They're like, we can book a Toys R Us. That doesn't exist anymore. What? No, but it speaks to her loyalty and her clarity.
Be loyal to your team. Be loyal. The grass is not always greener.
No.
Be loyal. And I think that's a big miss in this business. A lot of people are always looking for the next best thing. Mm-hmm. They're not happy in that moment, and they go searching for it, and you're never going to find it.
You mentioned how hard it is to get anything going right now, says the person with 18 shows on the air. But I'll just take that with a slight
– I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So I will save your company,
I'll take
Let Greg know. Text him.
It's like a huge pile of gold and you walk with one gold coin. Here you go. But you did mention how hard it is, and it is for most people. Sarah, where do you see the TV business heading? Because you have all these new streamers, especially Warner's now has Kevin Reilly running the streaming service and Amazon and Apple and everybody's gearing up and Hulu's gearing up and Disney Plus is gearing up. A, where do you see the business heading, the TV business? And B, where are those opportunities for women in this changing landscape?
I think the business is, are you saying before the world implodes and is on fire?
Well, that's different. When that happens.
When there's no more Earth. I don't know who's going to subscribe to Hulu. I just don't. I'm sure Disney will figure it out. Yes. They will find everyone in a cave.
I'll still be with my kids' agent.
No, but I think the business has had the film business has had a really rough, you know, when I first left, my friend just sent me a screen grab of some of the comments on Deadline when I left Warner Brothers, and everyone was like, she got fired. Right. You can't tell me anything. Like, why would you? Greg's a nice guy, but like, why would you ever?
Television.
Yeah, like television. And all those same people that I was like, no, I didn't get fired. And they're like, yeah, no. Yeah, I'm sure you didn't. Like 3 years later, were calling me like, how do you get into television?
Yep.
And I think that there is, the movie business is in a really hard spot. It's hard to figure out what gets people to the theater, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, for everyone but Disney. Disney mm-hmm. seems fine. But I think the television business, because it is expanding, it does seem, look, on the one hand, it seems like it'll be harder and harder to have another hit like Big Bang, you know, or yeah. Game of Thrones. But on the other hand, like, I mean, I loved Chernobyl. I thought Chernobyl was brilliant. Mm-hmm. If I was a buyer, I'd be like, no one's going to watch Chernobyl. Mm-hmm. You want to spend $100 million on 5 hours of Chernobyl?
And from a comedy writer?
Yeah, from a comedy writer.
Who wrote a scary movie?
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, but it's like, but it was great.
Yeah.
And it was captivating, and it did unite people. And so I think, if anything, that's the lesson, that where the hits are going to come from are really always going to continue to be surprises in television. It's very, like, egalitarian in that sense, mm-hmm. you know? Game of Thrones, if you told me I would, like, be fighting over, like, whether or not a dragon lives 8, 10 years after watching a pilot, like, and you know, so I think good storytelling finds a way. I think it will in movies too, but I do feel like I think the TV business feels very healthy and robust. I think it's going to be hard with all these streamers to just, eventually it's just going to be like cable, right?
Right.
Like, you're just going to have 10 subscriptions instead of one. Right now you have one cable subscription, but you get HBO, you get ESPN.
Well, you have these add-ons that people forget. It's just the way you're built.
Yeah.
And everybody loves to freak out over every new technological advance, whether it be television. When it first started, that was the apocalypse. That's all people were going to do. To VHS, that was the end of everything. DVD certainly was the end of everything. So it's just, you have a cable subscription, but you can have basic cable, then you have all these premium add-ons. It's just going to be the same thing, only just different subscriptions.
But I think that the at a certain point there'll be a kind of, what's it called, when like prices come back down to earth?
Yeah.
You know, there'll be that sort of
an adjustment,
because I think like the Netflix model seems hard to just keep going infinitely, but I think that what's cool about there being so many different buyers, and hopefully these buyers continue to hire people that aren't just from the networks. I see a lot of these like streamers that are hiring network executives, right. and they've been really trained into thinking in a network way. And I think the most interesting cable shows are not, they wouldn't have worked, they wouldn't have been on a network. And right. so, the hope is that they continue to innovate and continue to be open to these different kind of stories and voices. You know, I love Insecure. I think that show is amazing. And I'm so happy HBO saw this like web show and was like, yeah, let's do that. You know, I think that there's room for, it's almost like there'll be more pockets of great entertainment. I don't know that there'll be as many sort of like universally beloved shows, but I'm sure there'll be some that find a way, and they'll be surprising.
Sure.
They'll be about dragons and direwolves and Chernobyl.
Yeah.
I know, it's crazy, because I'm going to be living in the Stone Age, but I get a lot of people coming up to me saying, how does it feel to be on the last, you know, multicam sitcom that's ever going to be a big hit? I mean, people say that to me all the time, and my response is, I really hope that's not true. Like, I'd love to see another one come up. I grew up on shows like this. Mm-hmm. It's probably just about over. I hope that it's not.
I think it's all cyclical, though.
Yeah.
I mean, for a while, it was in the 80s, it was only multicams.
Right.
And then suddenly, like, single cams became cool.
Yep.
And then it'll just, people
want to
laugh.
It's also what you focus on.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, too. So when you left Warner's to go with Greg, everybody said, what the f*** is she doing? It's self-fulfilling, right? So it's like at that point, it was like, oh, features are the only way to go. If you're a television writer, you're a television writer. If you're a television actor, you're a television actor. Once that shifts, the tendency is to say, well, features are dead. Everybody's going to TV because all the best shit's being done on television, which I agree sort of with that. And also, people forget the streamers also make movies.
Yeah.
I've made 3 Netflix movies. So, and I have 2 more that we're hopefully going to make.
We're doing one that starts in October. Yeah.
Which didn't exist. So, and that would, I guess, consider
people
television.
It's like the weeds that find a way to sunlight.
Always.
You know, we'll figure it out. If there are stories to be told, and there are people want to be told stories. It's just finding the way to connect.
Yeah.
The
and
two.
Where I think people get into trouble in terms of just their psyche and how they live their daily life, is to think how do we get people to go to the theater? Well, it's very easy. You're being shown very clearly. Have a Marvel movie or Star Wars. No. And then that's that. It's a rock concert, right? So some shows you'll go out and watch live, and some you'll stay home and you'll watch. Who cares? It's harder to like have that big breakout hit now, you know, especially for producers that used to get first dollar gross and things like that. But there's so much more opportunity to make things, different things, you know, things that have different voices now that, you know, a movie like Booksmart.
It's like Booksmart and Rocketman were my two favorite theatrical experiences.
But that's great. And yeah. So even if you don't see Booksmart in the theater and you see it on whatever streamer, you'll see it.
See it as soon as you can.
Everybody will.
You'll see it eventually.
And it will live forever. And it's great for everybody who made that movie. And so much of it is thrown into, you know, it's a failure because it didn't do this. But these things live, you know, forever. On all these different ways that you can consume this content.
Greg and I just had this conversation with someone this morning about that. And it's true. It's like, by the way, one of my favorite movies of all time, Heathers, I think made like 7.5 cents.
Oh, I will tell you.
Like
that coming up made $2 million.
Yeah,
so here's what the reason why I know that is so many people when I was at Disney, when I was executive, would start a pitch with, this is like Heathers. And I'm like, okay, that movie made $2 million. You got to stop pitching
that's
it
so
like
funny.
That. If you want to shoot for that, you're not going to get your movie made. So I think we have to stop with the vocabulary of the theatrical experience. Movies are movies. It's just content that takes 2 hours to tell a story, beginning, middle, and end. Whereas Chernobyl took 5.5 hours or whatever. I'm trying to figure it was like an hour-ish each episode. You know, Game of Thrones took as long as it took to go. So we have to stop thinking about features versus television because it's becoming so amorphous in terms of how those things cross over. And yes, I think we've seeded – it's the big rock concert now. You know, it's like, all right, there's going to be these big stadium shows and there's going to be these smaller shows. That's fine. We're going to make great content. We're going to keep doing what we're doing, especially in the comedy space right now. It's like – it's so easy to say, oh, the comedies aren't working. No, they're not working because they're going up against these massive movies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. People are making choices to only go to one thing for the weekend. So let's figure out a different way to do it.
Well,
bring the cost down, put it on a streamer.
Expensive. Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing is I learned when I was at Warner Brothers with movies, people would be like, oh, we can make this for like $10 million. And I'm like, that doesn't help me. They still don't know how to market it for less than 40.
That's the issue. The issue is, and I think why streamers is the new revolution in the way that DVD was. I really believe that because of the marketing. Because the marketing departments in most studios still are forced to go through the traditional media, which is commercial buys and things like that. Your show, which I'm sure was ungodly expensive to buy. And as something like Netflix, they don't have it. It's completely linear marketing to their subscribers. They can get your eyes in front of it. They know what you watch. And they go, oh, Sarah, you like that? You're going to love this. And they put that up in front of you. And then they just take out billboards in L.A. to intimidate all the other buyers. So
just around the house of whoever directed the
star. Yeah, exactly. Or they know if you go down Sunset Boulevard, every billboard is Netflix. So if you don't know, you think – whoa. There's nothing else being made besides Netflix thing. It's just the way that they decide because all the Academy, you know, the Emmy voters and things live here. So they're like, watch us. We're going to dominate this town. You go to Cleveland, there's no Netflix posters. No. I'm sure. That's what's the really f***ing with the movie business is the $40 million marketing spend because it just f***s the
also
P&L
what
up.
People forget is that the studios only get half of that money. So if a movie makes $100 million, the theater owners get 50 and the studio gets 50. So it's not like they don't even the financials of film is just so daunting. And a movie like Booksmart, which I think is successful by every metric except maybe in retrospect maybe not so many theaters right away. You know, I think that's like
or not at all.
Yeah, or not
at
all.
Which is fine.
Although I did really enjoy seeing that in the theater, but I know I was, you know. But I think what we define as successful is become and you have like website, you know, everyone's somewhere along the way and I don't remember when it was, but suddenly everyone was aware of box office.
Oh, yeah. No, I'll tell you exactly what it was. It was the Hollywood Reporter and Variety started to list the box office. And the reason they did that is because of the first dollar gross. All the first dollar grosses were you know, hinged off of the Variety reporting. So it became this thing where it was like we used it as a metrics for our first dollar gross back ends. And then people just started going, and here's how insane.
But that became the story. And that's became crazy.
Here's even more insane. Yeah. Yes, that became the story. And then opening weekend became the story. And then profitability. And then now Thursday nights became the story. But here's now how insane it's gotten. You can tell a journalist a number, right? So I'm going to make this up. Toy Story. Toy Story is tracking to open to $140 million. First of all, nobody knows that number. It's a high, medium, low range. So the studio gives a number. If you don't hit that number, it's not a hit. And the number is totally bullshit. Like you could say, Toy Story is tracking to open to 50, which would be a fucking disaster for that studio. And if it made 60, they'd be like, it overperformed tracking. Who gives a shit? It's still going to lose $100 million.
Right.
That's how insane it's gotten. We've drilled down so much into the economics of it where people's experience in a theater is somehow better or worse if the movie's profitable or not, which makes no sense.
I know. Everyone became so aware of the machine.
Yeah.
In a way that's like really... I think distracting from the experience.
And they think about Chernobyl. It's like, well, it costs $100 million. I'm not going to see that. This doesn't make any sense. What do you f***ing care? Yeah. Go watch it. Who cares how much it costs? Obviously, the people who finance it care how much it costs. But we've put so much pressure.
And by the way, I made up that budget. I have no idea what it was. That was just my, that was my guess.
Whatever it is. Whatever it is doesn't matter. Again, yeah. How about this? I'm in the business and you said it and I go, well, she must know.
I just assumed.
I can tell you know how much BookSmart costs because that's in every story.
Yeah.
It leads every story.
And it's funny. I just went to my high school reunion for my fifth reunion, of course.
Yes. Just
graduated last year.
Right.
And one of the like reviews in the paper was all about this movie that just came out, and the whole first paragraph in this high school paper was about the box office.
Yes.
And that was like insane to me that it's become a sport in a way. And luckily TV is not as much that. You know, we do this show called You. And I'm really proud of it. And that was a show that was really hard to get on the air. And when it was on Lifetime, 675,000 people watched it. And then it went on to Netflix and 40 million.
Yeah.
And it just also goes to show you, like, it's the luck of the draw of the platform you're on.
Mm-hmm.
But it also shows you that if you just make something you believe in,
it'll find its place.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I love that story about you. I had no idea when you told me that a little while ago. I really was amazed by that.
Seinfeld. Seinfeld would have been canceled after two episodes
today. And the world would be 1 second.
The world would be deeply deprived.
Yes.
It would not be as good of a world if that had happened.
It would have been, though. You're right.
One of the best phone calls I've received in my career, because it was totally unexpected and really great, was my friend Scott Stuber called me. I was in Atlanta shooting Tag and got me and Marlon on the phone to talk about how successful Naked was all over the world. And why I love that story so much is he was number one in Scandinavia for 2 weeks. And, you know, all these places you wouldn't think a quote-unquote African-American movie, which it wasn't, by the way. It was a romantic comedy, happened to star him, worked all over the world. It was so great and satisfying because he's a good friend of mine. And I knew it from doing White Chicks and Little Man that he worked all over the world. But the traditional studio, you could never get a P&L. They would put zero
for international. And they would be like, well, it's because people are racist. And, you know, also like Will Smith, though, who I had the privilege of working with a million years ago. He made such an effort. He went around the world. Mm-hmm. He did the junket in every country and every market. And then suddenly it didn't matter.
Yeah.
So, which proves to you that it's not about that anyway. It's like that no studios were sending black actors to international junkets because, you know, it becomes this self-fulfilling
prophecy.
That's
what I'm saying. I think now that people are writing television that are talented and there's no stigma to that. By the way, same thing with Marvel. You can remember back in the day when it was like, besides Batman, every other one, you know, was Howard the Duck and all these other things. Nobody.
I was at the premiere of that.
Yeah, nobody was writing these movies. That was like something you did if you couldn't get any other gig. Then now the best of the best of the best are writing these things.
Yeah.
It's just where you put your energy. So now that we have all these streamers and all these ways and television is expanding and there's ways to tell all these stories, where do you see the opportunity for women right now?
I think it's for female writers, it's continuing to tell stories about complicated, interesting women, putting them in the center of the frame. I mean, metaphorically speaking, but like if you look at Handmaids, literally Elizabeth is in the center of every frame, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and writing those stories. And then like some of them will get made and then they will be successful. And then suddenly the new rule will be that movies mm-hmm. that shows about women work. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's to keep doing, to not feel like you have to alter your voice to fit the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And to let the marketplace come to you. So, and I also think there are so many incredible actresses. You know, unfortunately, Kaylee in my project, Kaylee was already attached, so we couldn't find anyone else. Yeah,
but there's really so many about that.
Yeah, there's so many great actresses that are just looking for. I mean, Elizabeth Moss can't be in everything.
Right.
I mean, she is the Michael Jordan of peak TV. you know that there are so many talented actresses out there, and just getting the chance to get on these. You know, we do this show called Doom Patrol that I love that hasn't quite been on the right platform to reach this broad audience. And there's this actress Diane Guerrero who is on Orange is the New Black for a million years, and she's great. But on this show, she plays a woman with like a multiple personality disorder and is like phenomenal. And so you realize how many actors have talent that they don't even get to scrape the surface of. And so the more complicated characters we create, the better it is for actors, the better it is for the audience. It just then it becomes its own cycle. And so my advice to female writers is to keep writing stories about women, and to male writers, if you want to be smart, write stories about women and then find women to help you continue to write them. Yes.
But it's what you said, you know, the women who are coming at this writing, the guys won't be able to write as authentically and as interestingly and as deeply probably as somebody who's lived it or somebody's coming at it from a different experience. Those stories will feel new and fresh. And people will be hungry for those because we haven't seen them a million times from you know the white old guy perspective.
No,
I am in that club, unfortunately.
I'm friends with Nanotchka Khan, who did Always Be My Maybe, you know, and that was like just a delightful romantic comedy.
It was.
But by being set in a specific city in a specific time, with specific actors that played to those actors' strengths, you know, it felt so fresh. And that's the thing. We like certain stories. We like hearing them over and over again. We're still little kids asking for the same bedtime story.
Right.
It's just we have to find ways to tell them in sort of a fresh way.
Right.
And some of that is in, like, who's telling them.
Yeah.
What directors are telling them, what writers are telling them, what actors are telling them. And I think that's – and it's never – you know, white male writers are not being displaced.
No.
You know?
No.
And there's room – and there's value and room for experience and all that stuff. But it is – it's like the more voices you hear from, the better the sort of chorus sounds.
Not only are they not being replaced, I think that's the other thing is we all have to realize that this business is expanding. It's not contracting. When you started, you know, acting, there were three networks.
Right.
And there was 100 and something movies that were being released by four companies. And then all of a sudden all these independent companies started sprouting up, and then you know the movie business expanded, and with DVD it expanded even further. And now with streamers, TV is exploding, but it's not contracting. And I think that is the thing. That is two things have stuck with me. Stop apologizing. First of all, you don't need to earn your spot. And second of all, you obviously have. So, and I feel like that is the thing for women. Just don't apologize. I've never had a guy, even a young guy on here, go, I earned my spot and I feel like I'm ready now. They're always like, I went in, found a book and I f-ing did it. And it's like, okay, because you're, you know, because that's the way you were raised. So just that's a piece of advice, I guess. But secondly, also just, and I just think it's so important in terms of both of you, of just, be fearless and know that it's expanding and there's plenty of room. And it's not like it was when you were coming up as an executive, like there's one woman and if I have another woman, then it's only going to be one woman. There's plenty of room, especially in the creative side, for writers and actors and directors and producers to create great things. And the thing about Elizabeth, which is so fascinating, it happens like that. Like, all of a sudden, she explodes.
Oh, overnight.
It's not like she wasn't on shows before.
Yeah, exactly. But and it is. It's just opportunity and timing. But I still remember there's a New York Magazine cover that was like, has Peggy been the lead of Mad Men all along? And I was like, oh, my God, she has been.
Yes.
She's the only one that had an arc.
Yeah.
You know? And so you can – then the writers built that, you know, and they did that. And I think there's always room for that. And, you know, Hollywood is a depressing but true good piece of advice that I got early on in my career – actually from my friend Kira Goldberg, who's at Netflix now, was it's not a meritocracy. mm-hmm. and the projects don't love you back. And yes. those are the two yes. two great pieces of advice. And it's not a meritocracy, and that just can make you feel better when it doesn't feel fair.
Yeah.
But the part that is can be a meritocracy is when the audience gets it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's about continuing to just push forward. I also think, especially if the theme of this episode is women and, you know, I, early on in my career, I really looked for models, and there are some that are really powerful and strong in front of the camera, behind the camera. I mean, for you, Penny Marshall, I think is a great,
great example.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think, like, I read the, Dawn Steele wrote this book, mm-hmm. They Can Kill You, But They Can't Eat You, mm-hmm. I think. Linda Obst wrote an amazing book. Mm-hmm. And reading about these, and Julia Phillips,
yep.
and reading about these women that were doing it back then, you know? And mm-hmm. Dawn's book is incredible.
I worked with Dawn.
Yeah.
When I was dizzy. She was amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And definitely gone too soon. But yeah. but her strength fortified me, yeah. you know? And Linda Obst is still doing it. And I think take the time to learn about the people that came before you.
Absolutely.
I think that's also a little bit of a generational problem.
Oh my God.
You have every piece of information at your fingertips.
Yes.
Yeah, so true.
But you don't want to hear about any of it.
And it will also make you feel better because you know that it's happened before. Like, we're not living in a moment where this has never happened before, where technology has completely upended the apple cart and the media has said the business is over. Every generation, it's been over. Like, every, you know, you go back and read in the 30s, the big studio movies were so overblown, it was over, and then these yep. little indies came in,
yes.
and in the 70s, it happened again. So it just finds a way to reinvent itself. And it makes me insane that people don't read and understand how this started.
Oh,
how
my
did
God. No, and you hear about, like, Warren Beatty fighting for Bonnie and Clyde,
yeah.
you know, and that's that trusting your gut. Like,
yep.
what do you believe is – what do you think is a story worth telling? And you have to just keep – I mean, it can take a decade. I'm working with this incredible producer who was one of the producers that Called Me By Your Name, 13 years.
Yep.
If you start thinking about the per hour pay that producers get, it's not good.
No.
It's below minimum wage. But eventually, you know, it gets made.
Goes back to your original quote.
I think what's cool too, and looking at the future and women in this business, for me and this little company that I started, starting Yes Norman, I think what's been cool is actually giving some opportunities to some girls that are upcoming. Like, I feel like every single day I have new meetings with young writers, mm-hmm. 18, 19, 20-year-olds that come in, and they're pitching these fun ideas, and I get to finally sit there and hopefully give them an opportunity like one that I had years ago. People took meetings with me too. I was absolutely nobody way before Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a cool platform to be able to give someone else an opportunity and voice it, and because that's the future. They're sitting right in front of me.
Yeah.
And these girls they're absolutely amazing. They have incredible stories to tell. They're from so many crazy walks of life, and I get to sit there and take it and hopefully bring it and turn it into something.
Well, you guys can recognize those great stories,
like,
as opposed to a guy who's, like you said, who's from Harvard, who's been doing the same thing, hiring the same people, hears the story, and is like, what? And then that becomes, you know, Always Be My Baby, you know, or any of the great romantic comedies that have been done on Netflix recently.
But I think it's like Kaylee's in a position, I'm in a position, you're in a position, we're all in these positions where we can help champion the people coming up. Kind of, you know, in front of us. That's something Greg's always been amazing at, as setting an example of. And you find people that are talented, and you help them, and you support them, and you nurture them, and you protect them.
Yeah.
And then at some point they forget, and then later on they remember, and they
then
take
you
to lunch.
Remind them again.
And you were the first person to ever hire me. I have so many of those.
Me too.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, my God.
But you know what? It's really nice. I just got one of those calls yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like, he wants to reach out because you're the first person who ever gave him a job.
Right.
And it's nice, you
that's
know?
Really
and
cool.
And that's the other reason to keep just betting on young people.
That's only because they don't have agents right now. That's the only reason any of them are reaching out.
Also, you never know where anyone is going to end up.
I don't f***ing have a job. I got to go.
But I had a director take me out to lunch a couple months ago, and I gave him his first film, and he wanted to have lunch, and he's like, I thought he was like, oh, he wants to talk about getting into TV or something. And instead he goes, oh, I don't want anything from you. I just wanted to say thank you.
That's so rare, great. By the
it's
way.
It's very rare.
No
it's very rare,
that.
And you can't do it for
it's
that.
Because the world
but
is
you,
ending.
You,
everybody's
exactly.
just trying to make,
make peace
make
before,
peace
before leftovers. Yeah. No, but I think that there is, like, we can always do that. And I also think the other thing I think is great, and it's you don't even have to have a ton of power. And I'm very lucky that whenever I also know I've got Greg Berlanti, you know, he's got my back, and we know each other so well that I can sort of speak for him, and we share the most important values. But also, it's like, if you say to showrunners, it's really important to me that half of the directors are women on this season. They're not. They're usually like really open to it.
Okay.
It's not until suddenly. Right now, the problem that we have, which is actually a great problem to have, is like all the female directors are all working so much.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. There's not enough of. They're not,
yeah.
So there's another opportunity.
Yeah.
For women.
Exactly. And so
come
that's,
in and be directors.
Oh my God! If you want to be a director and you want to direct in TV, and there's some great programs to help, and it's really hard to get that first episode, mm-hmm. but once you do. There's so much opportunity.
So I always ask this question at the end. I'll start with you, Kaylee, because I think I know, although maybe I don't. Best day on set.
Best day on set. You think you know?
I don't know.
It's a lot of days on
set.
Hey,
listen.
Oh, you mean any set ever?
Any set ever.
Oh.
I'm following you on Instagram, so it was a lot of last day.
Last day on
Big Bang.
I know.
Pictures and.
That was traumatic.
It was almost really traumatic. It was almost a minute by minute.
It was
update.
Insane. I had to.
But
didn't know another life.
Just a great day on set.
Great day on set. I would probably take it back to 16 years old, 8 Simple Rules with John Ritter. Being on set shooting, like, you know, you're shooting in front of the audience, but being like behind the stage ready to come out, and him back there just messing with me.
That's
and
awesome.
I remember it like it was yesterday, and he would with me until I had to go out, and my face would be red almost in tears because I was laughing so hard. And I remember those moments. I'll remember them forever. And I try and do that now with people that I work with. Like, I want to keep that fun energy. I always feel him there. I always feel him
great.
Making a joke. Yeah.
That's great. Sarah?
That's so hard.
I know, but it's fun to ask.
Yeah, no, for
it
sure.
Is hard.
I mean, I think in my producing in the last 5 years, I'd say probably the most fun was doing the Riverdale pilot because we'd spent years trying to do it. I'd originally bought it as a movie. I mean, it was mm-hmm. really years in the making, and seeing Lee Tolan Krieger shooting Camilla playing a Latinx Veronica, which was, you know, a big deal.
Yeah.
And having her walk in slow motion, basically stealing a shot from LA Confidential and just feeling like, oh, wow, this really happened. That was a great day on set, but I've had so many. That's what's great. You know, it's like hearing De Niro tell stories about Scorsese. That's a great day on set.
Yeah.
You know, watching Clint Eastwood work is a great day on set.
Mm-hmm.
Watching Tim Burton. I mean, it's just you, like, there have been so many great days on set, but it really is. There's also just the great days of the fun you can have when you're in the middle of it.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Kaylee, this is your first podcast.
My first podcast, Todd. I got to tell you, I've been listening to your podcast.
Oh, thank you.
And I really mean this. I'm not just kissing your ass. I love podcasts. It's all I listen to. But I have learned so much listening to yours. That's why I really wanted to be on it, but I was too scared to come alone. So, Sarah, thank you for coming with me.
I learned a lot, too, doing it. So, thank you, you've done
an awesome job. So, this
thank
is really
you.
Awesome.
But it's so cool because it gives people that don't have an in into this business
yes.
a way
yeah.
to hear about it. Because there is no one path to success.
No.
There are so many. You have to forge your own path in the woods with a machete, but and it'll only make sense when you look backwards. But there, I didn't have any connections.
Me either.
You know, and you just work hard and you put your head down and you do your best and you trust your gut about material.
Yeah.
That's ultimately the great divider.
Yeah. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Kirsten Woodward and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use #producersguide on Twitter. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Download new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.